Wow. Well, thank you everyone for your encouragement. I've never seen so many comments on the podcast, and as per your request or instructions, I'll continue to talk about my experiences in Krishna consciousness. And I just want to clarify that once again, even though it was written on the website that this is from my diary, but I really don't have a diary. I've never kept one. And what I'm reading from right now are just some notes that I made for a similar course that I was going to give in detail at the Namhara camp this summer, which I missed due to sickness. Right now I'm sitting here in the boathouse, that is, in the apartment on top of the boathouse out in the country, a couple of hundred miles north of Toronto. Very beautiful, peaceful. There's no one around anymore because it's summer season's over, everyone's back to school, everyone's back to work. We flew in via a hydroplane, landed on the lake. Although this evening my aunt, my mother's sister, had some sickness, dizziness, vomiting. So after a couple of hours of excitement, my cousin took her to the hospital. All right, but let's continue with progressive experiences. I mentioned the first one. Being disappointed with material life, and then the gradual purification by the association of devotees, and being even in the same area or space that Srila Prabhupada walked and breathed and lived. And then what I took to be really accepting Krishna consciousness after rejecting bogus spiritual paths, particularly Guru Maharaj Ji. I began to identify with the Krishna consciousness movement. In fact, I began to identify with it so much so that in 1971, I dropped out of university. That was quite a traumatic time for my family. By that I mean my parents, because this was in my fifth year of university. And I think sometime in January, I just decided not to continue on. And instead, I went to Florida. The primary reason going to Florida was just to really get away from the consequences of having upset family. And one very strong experience that I remember at the present time was flying. We flew from Montreal to Miami. I went with one friend, and I remember that as we flew over New York, then I'd had enough knowledge of Krishna consciousness that I knew that Srila Prabhupada was often in New York, and I was thinking, boy, I wonder if he's there now. Maybe I should just go and meet him. And that thought really stayed with me, and I was very much intrigued by the idea of meeting Srila Prabhupada, and more specifically of accepting a guru or a spiritual master. By 1971, I mentioned I'd acquired a Bhagavad Gita, and it was the blue Bhagavad Gita, Macmillan Abridged Bhagavad Gita, that I had with me. And I mentioned this story before. Some devotees may remember of how I acquired that Gita. I actually went to the temple on Pine Street, and Vichara Prabhu commented on the podcast, so he'll remember. He's an old friend. In fact, he was my Sankirtan leader, took me and another devotee, Shukra Das, all the way out to the Maritimes doing book distribution. Anyhow, I went to the temple to buy Bhagavad Gita because reading other books on Indian mysticism, they told that was written there that if you really want to know about the philosophy of India, then you must read Bhagavad Gita. And I think it also stated that you can get a Bhagavad Gita from a Hare Krishna temple. Anyway, I went to the temple, asked for Bhagavad Gita, and I didn't have one. They didn't have a Bhagavad Gita to sell me, which was quite unfortunate. So then I proceeded to go to the bookshop. I remember that I went to the university bookshop right opposite McGill, and there were about a dozen editions of Bhagavad Gita, and I was going through them. Anyway, to make a long story short, the Bhagavad Gita that stuck in my hand was Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. That's the one that I picked up from the shelf, purchased. And when I went to Florida, I took that book with me. Myself and a friend, as I mentioned, we camped out in the Keys, what was it called? Long Pine Key, something like that. And I lived there for a month. Lived in tents. We didn't eat anything. We just lived off coconuts, actually. There were coconut trees all around. And so we lived off coconut pulp, drinking coconut juice. And that's all I ate for a whole month. And the only thing I did was read Bhagavad Gita, study Bhagavad Gita. The result of that studying of Bhagavad Gita was that I visited the Miami Temple. And when I went to the Miami Temple, it was a Sunday feast. It was a very nice experience, but the most important thing was that the devotee who was preaching to me, and I don't remember who it was, they had just received copies of the Krishna book, and they asked me if I wanted to purchase them. In fact, I hadn't even opened the boxes, and I said, sure. So I went to his apartment or flat, and they had these boxes of a big Krishna book. They're in two volumes, or maybe three volumes, I don't remember. Silver, very beautiful books. And I bought them from him, and he said that Srila Prabhupada said, if you read these stories before you go to sleep at night, then you'll dream about Krishna. And the real importance of my visit to the temple was, and I went repeatedly a few times before again going back to Canada, was that I really began to identify with Srila Prabhupada as an integral part of understanding Krishna consciousness. I remember that as I was studying the Gita in that tent, living out there in the Keys, I would just read the text itself, and I wouldn't read the purports, and I couldn't really quite understand why there had to be purports to what Krishna said. It seemed to me that it was quite self-evident what Krishna was saying. But after talking with the devotees and after hearing from them, something quite clicked, and it became very self-evident that what I thought was self-evident, Krishna's words weren't so evident, because devotees had a different understanding of it than I did. And the reason they had a different understanding is because they understood things as Srila Prabhupada explained them. And then I began to understand what was earlier on a sentiment that accepting a spiritual master was not just because you had to have one, but because without one, you couldn't really understand God, you couldn't understand Krishna. In 1972, I was back in Montreal, and my wife and I spent a lot of time visiting the temple, associating with devotees. We set up our altar. We would offer our foods. Of course, I was vegetarian a long time ago. And we would go on Sunday to the temple. I got to know devotees like Gokulnanda Prabhu and Urmashloka and Vishwakarma. And these devotees would preach to me and encourage me in devotional service. It's quite interesting that they never really quite told me to move in. That was something that just sort of came of its natural accord. However, I remember having very significant spiritual experiences in that time, some of which I'll mention now. And I've mentioned it previously to devotees, because the devotees in Florida had told me to read Krishna book before going to sleep, so I was in the habit of reading Krishna book, and sometimes myself and my wife would alternately read. And there were certain stories that I would read, and I would know what, without having read them before, I would know what the storyline was. I would know what it was that Krishna would be doing. Examples of this were Damodar Leela of Mother Yashoda trying to tie Krishna's hands in his hand, and her rope always being just 2 inches too short. Another one was Mother Yashoda looking into Krishna's mouth and seeing the universal form. So as I began to read these stories, then I knew what it was about, and I mentioned this to my wife. I said, you know, I remember this story from somewhere before. And I went to the extent of asking my mother whether she'd ever told me such things, and of course she hadn't. So I had to conclude that at some time in the past, in some more distant past, previous to this life, I'd had experience with this particular story, which means some connection with Krishna consciousness. And of course those experiences, as other devotees similarly have, really cemented my faith and increased my faith in the process of Krishna consciousness, in Krishna, and in what Srila Prabhupada was saying. We had beautiful pictures of Radha and Krishna, Brijbasi pictures, and I would just regularly sit and look at the picture of Radha and Krishna, and they were so extraordinarily attractive and beautiful. But aside from their beautiful features and the attractive influence that I was feeling, the attraction to them seemed to be not something new, but something both very natural, something very old, something that I'd remembered as I remembered the previous previous pastimes. And I felt really irresistibly drawn, although I couldn't really put words or explanations to why I was so attracted. But all in all, with the gradual awakening of Krishna consciousness, I began to identify more and more with devotional service as not only my belief, but actually my life, something that I couldn't really separate from myself. And this type of very strong identification was what would lead me to want to become a full-time devotee, a full-time preacher, and a sannyasi. Krishna consciousness was becoming more than just a religion. the type of religion that, for instance, I learned in church and then received confirmation, it was part of me, and it was not a small part of me, but rather it was a large part, or you could say the entirety of me. I couldn't really separate myself in any way from what Krishna consciousness was becoming in my life. Anyway, in 1973, things began to accelerate, and probably sometime in about February, I decided that I was going to join the temple, and I drew a deadline of May 1st. My wife wasn't exactly in the mood for joining a temple. She was a good devotee, and even through this period of a year and a half when we were serious practitioners, sometimes our association with devotees would wane, but she would always make offerings to our altar. Everything that we ate would be offered. She would chant rounds, and we would talk to each other, preach to each other. However, she didn't envisage that she wanted to move into a temple, but rather she'd like to continue as what we call nowadays a congregation member. Anyway, we continued to go, and of course a major turning point and experience was prasadam. And whereas I was always very attracted to the prasadam, the Sunday feast, I remember the Gaur Purnima of 1973 as being some kind of real major turning point. Somehow there wasn't any good communication, and we were told that there was going to be Gaur Purnima and there would be a feast. I took it that that would happen at the same time as the Sunday program. Anyway, we got there and the feast was already over. So devotees sat us down, and I think it was Gokulananda Prabhu, who was a very jolly devotee, and he was the devotee who first taught me how to do Sankirtan on the day after I moved in. And so he said, "Well, there's no more prasadam. You came, the feast's gone." And of course, when they had a feast, then there would be no more prasadam because the devotees really ate everything. But he said, "All right, we'll wait here." So about a few minutes later, he came back with a bucket, and that bucket was probably about a 5-gallon bucket. And it was full of all the leftovers from the feast, but it was leftover sweets. It had halva in it, and sweet balls, and burfi, and all kinds of sweets. And it was just all mixed up inside. And he said, "Take this." So we took it, and I left. And we ate that bucket. That means we means me, my wife, and my dog, Angus. Angus was a big German shepherd who by this time was a vegetarian. And we ate those sweets, and it was just, I remember just eating the halva and then coming across a Simply Wonderful, coming across some sandesh, some burfi, and it was all spilt over with sweet rice, and it was just a wonderful thing that just really set me flying. And made me an addict to prasadam, particularly Simply Wonderfuls. And the other experience was kirtans. Udhamasloka was the temple president, and he was a wonderful person, very kind person. He was a great musician, and he sang fantastically. So on the Sunday programs, we would have these kirtans, but he would actually be sitting at an organ and singing and playing in an organ while others would play drum and kartals. And I would dance. I was 23 years old at the time, in ecstasy. And that was the kind of ecstasy that I'd never experienced before, the ecstasy of chanting and dancing. When we came to the temple, then generally my wife would wear a sari, one of the ladies would put her in a sari, and then I purchased a dhoti, and I asked permission whether I could wear a dhoti outside, and I started going everywhere in dhoti and kurta and tilak, even though I had long hair at the time. And of course, a consequence of walking around like that would be that when we went shopping or somewhere where people had the opportunity to ask us why we were dressed like that, we would have to explain. And we'd have to explain that we were Hare Krishna devotees, and why were you Hare Krishna devotees? And this was the beginning of my surrender. Surrender because I'd marked a date that we have to move in. I have to make Krishna consciousness my life. And because I'd made the decision to surrender, more than just gaining faith and becoming convinced of the process of devotional service, we also began to taste bliss. Sometime in March, or maybe in March, Subal Swami came to visit the temple. And that was another sort of past life experience. When I saw him and devotees told me he's a sannyasi, and I asked what's a sannyasi, and they told me sannyasi is a lifelong celibate, someone who just preaches, has nothing to do with his family, then as soon as I heard that, I just said, that's what I want to be. Immediately, that a desire awakened in me to be a sannyasi, a desire that was there previously. And because it seemed to be an awakened desire, not something new, but something that was just dormant. Of course, when I tried to explain this to my wife, she didn't particularly like the idea. I told her sannyasis don't even look at women. And she told me, well, he looked at me. But in any case, I was still determined to be a sannyasi. However, I gave her the benefit of the doubt that if she was going to move in the temple, then we would continue like that. But I couldn't keep with that determination for very long, determination to give her the benefit of the doubt. So sometime in mid-April, we sat down. At this time we were living out far out in the country, about 100 miles from Montreal, and I said, listen, I want to be a sannyasi. I want to join the temple in Montreal. You should go and join the temple in Vancouver. Vancouver's 3,000 miles west of Montreal. So that really blew her mind. Although we discussed it over the following days, I became more and more determined that I didn't want to continue with family life. My friend Vishwakarma, who was the vice president, he encouraged me like that. Temple president didn't know, but he did. So things came really to a head on the basis of this sannyas idea faster than I had planned. And therefore I couldn't really quite wait until May the 1st to move in. If I remember well, I moved in on April the 28th. I just packed Angus and my wife and whatever belongings we had into the car. We had some money saved up. I told her she could have the money because I already knew about the 50% rule, that you give 50% to the temple and 50% for family and emergencies. I said, well, forget the emergency, I'll give you my emergency money. I'll take the car and give that to the temple. We had a brand new Volkswagen Bug, and you take the money. And I went to my mother-in-law's. She was a horrible person, but all mother-in-laws are horrible. But this one was the real acharya of mother-in-laws. And I said, well, here's your daughter back. And she couldn't believe it. But I said, I'm going to join the temple. And I left my wife and Angus there. And then I drove to the temple. And that was the final act of surrender as a outsider, as a congregation member. And it was quite a extraordinary experience. I remember the drive going from my mother's-in-law to the temple. The temple is in more or less downtown Montreal, and that was about a good 30 miles away. The overall experience of just giving everything up, leaving everything behind, was so intense that I didn't know where I was driving. I couldn't see where I was driving. All I found out is that I was pulled up outside the temple. And I parked the car. I went inside. And I told Vishwa Karma, here I am. And he didn't quite know what it was that I meant. And I said, I've come to join. And he said, where's your wife? I said, well, she's not coming. And he said, great. And he proceeded to shave me up. We'll continue tomorrow. Hare Krishna.